on the road or off-road, Chevy Silverado is built for tough performance in any condition. Hit the road in a new Silverado pickup. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for a dealer near you. Chevy Silverado, official truck partner of the Chicago Bears.
Well, my next guest is a familiar voice to Chicagoans, not only from his time at The Score, but also as a columnist at the Sun-Times. Terry Bors has a new memoir out called The Score of a Lifetime, 25 years talking Chicago sports. Bors was one of the original voices featured on The Sports Talker, and in the book, he writes about getting The Score off the ground. Bors had plenty of on-air partners over the years, but cemented himself as talk radio royalty with his role on The Bors and Bernstein Show, which paired him up with Dan Bernstein, aired weekdays afternoons for 17 years. Bors retired from The Score about a year ago. In the book, Bors talks about his health problems, ultimately being diagnosed with cancer, and dealing with the effects of chemotherapy and radiation. Terry Bors currently splits time between here and Florida. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, I'm going to head to Florida in the winter. I have some softball commitments I've made. I've tried to get this old body into shape, so I'm going to play softball. And the only bad news so far with the softball is one of the guys that occasionally shows up and plays is Dante Bichette. I think that's a little bit out of my league.
Terry Bors, welcome to The Download. Great to have you. Long-time listener.
Well, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
First-time interviewer. So,
yes, you are.
Yeah, but where did the idea of a book come from for you? Because I listen to you, and I've always thought and taken from your personality that you don't like to look inward, that you're more of a guy
who's
where's the idea of coming up with a memoir?
You know, I said it one day on the air a long time ago that I promised it, because people wanted to know this, they wanted to know that, they wanted to know what happened here, what happened there, and I said, it'll be in the book. It's one of those things you just throw out so they leave you alone a second. If you got time now, I could tell you, but otherwise it'll be in the book. So after a while, when you sort of make that commitment, when you promise people and the number of people that you see, whether it's a remote or just in the street, wherever, I committed myself to it a long time ago. So I started putting notes together in my mind while some of it was fresh, because the older you get, the further away the memories get. So I had a lot of newspaper stuff left over, because I talked a lot about covering sports in the 80s, which I did, and had a lot of that stuff left over. Those notes were good. Notes were still good. The score, I needed a little help on here and there. You know, because when you're in the middle of it, you sort of miss some of the politics of it.
Right.
Some of the things that
happen.
Which
is actually a good thing, right? As a talent, you don't want to be in all the politics.
We had enough problem that convincing somebody to actually listen to the thing. So, I mean, that was the first problem we had. Is anybody listening? Anybody out there? We had no computers, so they would put like where we're sitting now, DM Radio, they would put whose caller on there. If there'd be a caller, maybe two a day. And they would have to put his name up there and print it and put it up on the wall, tack it up
on
the wall.
And this is what, 1992? This is the beginning of
92,
of the score.
Yeah.
You know, I think about that, and then I think, wow, it's great that talk show host Terry Bors is going to write a book. But then I remember, you had a long career in print. You were a writer and a columnist for the Sun-Times, other places. Talk about that. Talk about how that prepared you, or just the idea of getting back to the written word.
Well, I got back to the written word. I started in 72 at a smaller paper, and then went to a little bigger paper in 74, and loved it there. Loved the guy I worked for. Loved it enormously. But when you start having children, I don't know whose they were. They might have been mine. And you start having children and you go, all of a sudden, I'm not making enough money to we have to do something. Because I would have never left it. I would have been a lazy guy and just sit there. I was playing softball and doing everything I wanted to do and still married. But then all of a sudden it hits you that, So I talked to the Sun-Times. They said, well, we won't hire you to get to a bigger paper. I said, well, what? You're either I am or I'm not. Am I or am I not? And they said, nope. We'll talk to you if you get to a bigger paper. So I took a job at the Detroit Free Press, and I worked a desk and made me promise not to ask them to write. I didn't. Pretty soon I'm out writing. I buy a house, and 3 days after we buy a house up there, we'd been renting a house. 3 days after I buy a house, the Sun-Times calls and offers me a job on the desk. And I get to the Sun-Times, and they say, you don't want to, Marty Kaiser. I said, you're not going to write here either. I said, Okay. All right. I won't. I didn't. I said I didn't. I know what I signed up for. And the Bulls job, which, you know, I had never really done anything. I'd covered a little Tigers baseball, some Michigan State football and so forth, just odds and ends and when I was at the Free Press. And I thought, well, you know, I'd never really done a beat. So I didn't know if I could do it or not, because it's all in deadline. It's all, you got 15 minutes to do this. It's all the travel. It's all of the other stuff that goes with it. And you have to convince yourself you can do it. I mean, I know guys today believe they can do anything, but I had some doubt that you can do that. There's a difference between saying, well, yeah, I could sit down and write something, right, or I can sit down and write something in 15 minutes.
Right.
Thank God people weren't paying attention to the Bulls.
And a sport that I'm not you were familiar with, but wasn't necessarily familiar with this team,
right,
and with NBA basketball. There's a lot that goes into being a beat writer, especially in a different time.
It was a challenge. You know, I never had to write that fast. I worked at a paper. In Detroit, I almost blew the first deadline. I had 3 hours to write it, like 10 paragraphs, and couldn't do it. It was in my mind forever that, are you going to freeze every time there's like, well, there's no pressure, you know. Sometimes, generally, after the Bulls game got done, I had like a half an hour. You have to file an early story, and then I had a half hour to file the final of the game. Not that anybody was paying attention, because it was the perfect beat, because I love basketball, and it was the perfect place to go up until 84.
Right.
Then all of a sudden somebody came to town and things started to change a little bit. It took a little while. It took 5-6 years before they really got it together and got the players around Jordan. But when he got there, I just remember distinctly being the only one who was really excited about it. I mean, I thought, don't you know, it's like the Bears were the hottest thing going, right? The Bears are the story. The Bears are this. The Cubs had won in 84.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And the White Sox had won in 83. So it's like,
no one was paying attention to the Bulls.
Nobody was paying attention to the Bulls. And I thought, that's okay.
What I love about the book, too, is that you get into some of the specifics and some of the stuff I don't think I've ever heard about Michael Jordan when you think about the players around him at that time as a rookie. Larry Bird, other people. We know the Larry Bird quote, but some of his teammates coming out of practice saying, this is the greatest player that's ever played.
This is I've ever played against. Lockery said that to me after the first practice. He said, Terry, I just saw the greatest player who ever lived. I said, where was he, Kevin? He said, he's on the floor. I said, well, who was that? And it's like, don't tell him. Don't use
don't
that. Don't use that. And I said, I promise you, I won't use that. But yeah, you had guys. It's one thing about basketball, and they say the ball don't lie, right? One thing you know is when you know it when you see it. Baseball players are going to have bad days, and football players are going to have bad days, and basketball players are going to have some. But when you see that a certain talent level for the guy, you just know it.
Right.
I can see it, a young kid. I can see it. I mean, it is so. I mean, maybe just from being around those guys and knowing what it takes to be one of those guys. Because being an NBA player is that's a dream of a lifetime for a lot of people, and it's a terrific way to make a wonderful living. That's great to do it. But when you think about people who think, well, my kid's going to play in the NBA, I'm going, no. He may be a great player now, but there's such a difference when you watch them. And you go, I played that game. Not that game, though. I didn't play that game. And even guys who were great players in college would come into camp. Because when I started, there were 7 rounds of the draft.
Wow. Think about that now.
Second rounders
don't even make the roster.
That's
now.
Right. So you had seven guys coming in every training camp. It was like, oh my God, are you kidding me? I haven't even heard of this guy, and he was gone within like a week and a half anyway. But it's one of those sports where you just know it if you see it. I mean, it's hard to describe. I think you could probably say this some of other, maybe guys more of a scout's eye than I have. Mm-hmm. But basketball, after being around it, with him, and then covering a lot of basketball after I was off the Bulls, even doing NCAAs and all that stuff that in the Olympics, you just know it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no doubt you can watch a practice and you can watch, you know, 12 pro athletes going at it. I could sit down and write if you put no numbers on them, I could write you the starting lineup without even knowing who they are. I could tell you who they are. And I don't say I would be right, but you can tell.
Let's do this. Let's take a quick break. And I want to come back and talk about, because the next transition you made in your career was to columnist, which is a more natural transition to being a sports talker,
mm-hmm.
especially
yep.
at a new radio station in Chicago in 1992. Terry Bohr is my guest. His book, The Score of a Lifetime, 25 years talking Chicago sports. We'll talk with the iconic, the talk show royalty.
Oh, yeah,
talk
show
building
royalty.
Right now, Terry Bohrs at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, Terry Bohrs, the longtime host at the Bohrs and Bernstein show that wrapped up after 17 years last year at The Score. He's got a new book, The Score of a Lifetime, 25 years talking Chicago sports. Sit down and talk about your illustrious career in broadcast and in journalism, because we talk about in the first segment, just talking about you being a beat writer, but you made a transition to columnist, which is much closer to the idea of being a talk radio show.
Yeah, and there's no doubt. And I made it in 88. They offered the column to me, and I thought, well, I'll take that. Because we had a lot of guys were leaving, and I think John Shulian was the one who was left, who was a terrific writer. But I think I did all right with it. I mean, I critically acclaimed by some, and others thought I was an idiot. But that's okay. I was there to be both.
Columnist is supposed to be.
Yeah, I was there to be both. I mean, I wasn't a taste for everybody, but I always felt like you stay to who you are, and it's a whole different thing when you're covering the team than when you're the columnist, because then you're completely the outsider. It's like, And what do you want? Who are you? What are you doing here? Except Michael. Michael and I always got along. And that was the years when the Bulls were getting good. But our relationship was always great. But I would fight with Jerry Krause, and I came to appreciate Jerry Krause and what he said and what he did as the years went on. I think there's a certain thing to being a columnist. And I went to the 88 Olympics, which was a great time, a lot of fun there.
You know, as a columnist who had a background in being a beat reporter, so you had the relationship with athletes. But
yep.
as you mentioned, as a columnist, you're an outsider.
Oh, absolutely.
And sometimes you have to tell the story in a way that's not favorable to the team or to the athlete, right?
Yeah.
More than a beat reporter has to. Was it difficult to make that transition when athletes and because you talk in the book about, you know, your relationships with people like Mike Ditka or Ron Santo or others where
not good, yeah.
Not good because they remember words that you wrote about them at certain or talked about on the air.
It's funny, I never met Ron Santo in my life until Mike Murphy's wedding. And I never met him in my life. And he walked up to his wedding and said something untoward, and I guess he was listening to the score. Our paths didn't cross with me writing about him. So I don't know what the Ditka thing I understand. I completely get the Ditka thing. Because, look, I mean, I know he's America's hero, but if you pay attention, you're really not. And you look at it and you say, well, first of all, you can't tell guys not to do this and not to do that when you're doing everything. Right. How can you possibly?
Otis Wilson on his book talking about
how
that.
How can
same
you possibly
issue,
tell people, well, you can't take that ad. Don't do that. It takes too much of your time and all this. While you're riding around in Soldier Field in an armor outfit, you know, dressed like a knight. It's hard for me to justify in my mind. So I would write that. And also about the temper and the tantrums. Because remember, at a point there, he stopped speaking to Chicago media.
Right.
He's done with us. Which was fine with me. I didn't care. I was at the score by then. So when he took the job at the score, he had his own show at the score, for those who don't remember way back when, and really made the station. I'll never take that away from him because there were people all across the country all of a sudden recognize this, call and say, hey, wait a minute. You got Mike Ditka quotes?
And it was fresh. It was fresh before he was just fired by the Bears. I didn't understand that.
Yeah. You got Mike Ditka. Yeah, we have Mike Ditka quotes. And I had to do the show with him many times. It was like, oh. You know, we would not speak. We generally were out. We went out to a bar somewhere and, you know, so the people could touch him. Not that he really wanted to be kind of sort of circled around and didn't really mix with people very well, but we would not speak. We never exchanged a word off the air. Hmm. Never. We probably did it a dozen times and never once did we exchange a word off the air because I would look around and he would be up and gone. So thank you for holding a grudge. That's fine. And in my you know what it was? Imaginary columns, I used to call them.
But that's part of the job of being someone who talks and writes about sports. You have to be able to take because the athletes get so mad about it, and you'll see them, so Jay Cutler and others who get mad about Brandon Marshall famously had beefs with the media, even the players now that are on the floor. A lot of times they're talking about you. They're not necessarily talking about the beat writer. They're talking about when they say, oh, the sports in this town. They're talking about Terry Bourne.
Yeah, oh, I know. I know. I could deal with it. I mean, I wasn't necessarily welcome at them, but they couldn't refuse me. So I didn't have any real problem with the Bulls or the White Sox or Cubs, per se. Not really. But there's certain guys that I've gotten criticized over the years. Nobody likes it. Nobody likes it. Yeah. And sometimes I get it, sometimes I don't. And I just sort of put it aside and say, okay, that's certainly entitled to your opinion. And today everybody has an opinion. You can share it with everybody in the world if you want it. So I look at it and I say, well, okay. I mean, he clearly didn't like me, or this guy didn't like me. There's other guys who didn't like me. That's okay. The hockey people love me because nobody was bothering with hockey then. They love me. They love to see me coming out there and do a hockey column. And like I knew what I was talking about, but I would go out there occasionally and do a hockey column. There's just certain guys, no matter what you do, whatever walk of life you're in, you're just not going to gel with. Doesn't make a difference if you're writing about it, talking to them, if you deal with them every day, whatever it is. I'm sure that people can relate to a guy you just don't get along with. You just don't like him. I mean, he doesn't like you. You don't like him. You may know why. You may not know why. It doesn't matter. All you know is that you don't mix well together. But Ditka definitely made the station.
Such an interesting, and I want to get, we'll take a quick break here in a second just for the news, but the idea of chemistry and what makes good talk radio or sports talk radio, but also knowing that, you are a voice and a personality, and there are some people that are going to take in, some that aren't, and really is part of it. And now it must be a lot different with social media, but even in your time, and people calling up saying, you're a lousy bum, Terry Bourne.
Oh, Lord. Are you kidding me? I spent days arguing with people that hated me. So I, it's sort of one of those things that newspapers where you didn't catch a lot of criticism back because it wasn't social media, so you didn't know. But when you do radio, all of a sudden they're right on top of you. they're on that phone and they're on you. So I looked at it and I thought, well, that's an interesting spin in your life now that they can get you.
Did you have to adjust to that?
Yeah,
early
well, absolutely.
On? Did,
yeah, absolutely.
Play a role in emotionally how you handled your work?
Yeah, I did. I had to make adjustments throughout because I just, even though people find it strange, I wasn't used to screaming at people, but only those who were screaming at me, which is quite frequently. Like Ron Santo. I never met Ron Santo in my life. And all of a sudden, I'm a something, according to him. You know what you're talking about, but you're a, oh, okay, all right. And that leads to what? But the callers too, and it probably, the toughest time was the O.J. Simpson trial, early on in the station too in 95. It was so difficult because
callers
it was,
calling in.
Oh,
yeah.
Lord have mercy. And I mean, I'm not arguing black or white. I'm arguing right or wrong. It's got nothing to do with anything other than right or wrong. You either believe it or you don't. You believe the evidence or you don't believe. If you choose not to, I can't help
it's
you.
Very opinionated. Country was divided.
Oh,
there,
my
right?
God. And sadly, I think we still are. Very sadly, I think we still are. I thought things were getting better and that we were understanding each other better. And clearly, that's not the case. Wrong again. Wrong again.
Wrong again. That could have been the name of your book.
Yeah,
right?
It should have been Wrong Again.
Terry Bohr is in studio. His book, The Score of a Lifetime, 25 years talking Chicago sports. Of course, Terry Bohr's longtime fixture at The Score, 25 years, just retired a year ago. I was doing afternoons with Bernstein, Bohrs and Bernstein for 17 years. We'll talk about that and much more coming up here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, Terry Bohrs. The famous, famed talk radio
this world
royalty.
Famous is the celebrity thing
celebrity.
Is really odd.
But you are. I mean, you are in the way that, you know, Bohrs and Bernstein played for 17 years here. If you're into sports in the city of Chicago, you know that show, the new book, The Score of a Lifetime, 25 years talking Chicago sports. Take us back to 1992. The Score, you know, they say, hey, there's rumblings that there's going to be an all sports format. That wasn't done here in Chicago.
No, we were the Fan in New York opened in 87. I want to say the Whip in Philadelphia opened in 89. So it was only twice done in the country. It was an experiment, but I mean, you had to figure, even though part of me would just not allow that we could ever succeed because we had the daytime license only.
That's
we were
right,
doing
yeah.
afternoon driving off the air at 4:30. And my first partner really, I mean, really chafed at it because he's, you know, he produced it for Chet Kopic and knew radio and knew what was going on. And it really bugged him. And I said, everything bugs me about what we do. Never mind the fact that we're going off at 4:30. Everything about it is just strange to me. So I learned a lot from him, observing him. And we had hosted together when Kopic was gone. Oh, pray for those days. So we had gotten sort of a certain rhythm together.
You what know, did we you knew. Know about sports radio? The Fan was on, so people knew that. But for you in Chicago?
Nothing. I knew nothing.
What did you think of it? What was the thought in your head about, oh, this must be yelling at callers?
Yeah, I don't remember having one other than the fact that I sort of risked where I was and comfy. Certainly not ripped, but comfy. I mean, the salary had gone up a little bit with the
That's
column and so forth,
yeah.
but I had already lost the column. Right. I wasn't sure. That's the honest to God answer because we know Chicago is a great sports town. There's no doubt about that. So, I mean, there's always that part of me that goes, well, of course people are going to listen sooner or later. I mean, if they can. And then when the frequency changed to 1160, I found out later on they still couldn't hear in Lombard or the western suburb. So it's like
it's the early days of building a radio station.
Yeah,
right?
For the long time we were strictly fighting uphill. It was a battle that I wasn't ever sure we were going to win. And I think others might have been more positive about it than I was. Certainly when the station was purchased, they were more positive than I was about it. But for all of my heart, I felt this would work in Chicago. How could it not? How could a city this passionate about sports not take to an all-sports station? Early returns weren't encouraging. And by 99, when the change was made, when all the partnerships were rearranged and everything, the numbers were down again. And nobody could figure out why. 7 years into it, seven and a half actually, August of 1999, they just called me and said, you know, we're going to change
it up.
No more Dan McNeil, Dan Bernstein, who'd been covering the Bears and other reporting for the station. And it's like you're being told 7.5 years into it, you're a failure. Failed again. You failed again. I mean, you still have the job. But you failed again. And I mean, for me, and this is probably just who I was, but failure always weighs more heavily with me than success does. I look at success and celebrity and all that stuff as a kind of a, okay, if you say so. I find it hard to believe and hard to deal with sometimes because I don't, understanding, what I've learned more than anything else is guys like you, and everybody else who does radio anywhere, you really have an effect on people. You don't realize it. I'm not trying to affect people, but somehow I clearly did, as you and others, thousands of others who had that same effect on people. You just don't ever dream in your wildest dreams that people would be that close, that much attentive to a guy talking sports or care that much or want to know more, all this other stuff. So I still find it amazing when you read the stuff and you say, yeah, he did this and he did that, and and I'm going, oh, God. I really don't feel any of that. But one thing I've learned is the personal connection to radio is really something. It really is something.
The idea of failure, where do you think that comes from? Where do you think that comes? Because a lot of this book is split between the professional Terry Bores and the personal.
We get and to the know crazy, about your, yeah, the crazy one.
Get
yeah,
know
the,
about
the,
your relationships,
the goofy one.
With your parents, with your wife.
I just think that my fallback is always I failed. It took me a long time to be happy with doing the radio. Probably 95 when we were doing okay, and I started to feel better about it because you consistently worry the failure of it. When something happens, I always kind of feel like it's my fault. I mean, I'm working with a guy who well, not born in radio, but he did radio for a long time. He worked for Chet for 11 years, Dan McNeil. So it isn't him. It must be me. I mean, I don't think he thinks he failed because he was him being himself. That's who he is. If you listen to that, that's exactly who he was. And I thought I was being me, but if that me was no good, then whose fault is that? It's me. I guess the best way I dealt with failure is I always just blame myself. I mean, it isn't for my parents. My mother never did. She cut me slack on the stupid stuff I did. My dad did too. I always sort of felt like, where was I going and when was I ever going to get there? I had four kids by then, and because my last sons were born in 1983, the twins. I looked at it and I said, well, I haven't failed as a father yet, I don't think. Some people think I failed at newspapers. Some people think I failed at radio. So, I mean, the career is sort of marked by more failure than it is success to me. I mean, I look at it and I say, well, I made people mad at the Sun-Times for something I didn't really intend to do. And I still don't believe I did it. I'd have to find the column and read it over again to say that.
Is this the Marlboro Man stuff?
Are you kidding me? I'm not that clever. I couldn't write that. That wasn't it at all. I mean, I'd happily say, yeah, I'm so clever I tried to get that paid. I didn't. I didn't try to do that. I guess my fallback has always been, look, if there's something wrong, don't look around.
Yeah.
Don't be a thumb guy. Yeah, me.
Apologies to who you had dinner with. I forgot towards the end of the book, but they talked about that you have to look at life as a win.
Jerry DiNardo.
But that was a big part of the philosophy of what you take away from your career.
Mm-hmm.
That regardless of everything else that happened, the station, everything else, your life, Terry Bores, is a win.
Yeah, it is a win. And I took Jerry. I'd never heard that expression before. I must be so far out of touch with reality.
No, I didn't hear it either.
But when he said that to me, he said, I don't know what you're worried about. You've already won at life. And I thought about that later on. And he's such a great guy, such a terrific guy. Not unlike a lot of college football coaches, you know, who you just have to wash your hands when you get done with him. Is there a towel handy? Can I just leave now? He's a genuinely good guy. And when he says it, a guy who's obviously succeeded to a very high level, but I think when he said that, it finally helped me straighten my head out a little bit. It really did. And I told my wife, I said, you know, I don't want to declare a win at this point. She said, no, you did. You won. You won. She said, look
four
around
kids
you.
Through college?
Yeah. She said, right? We got all four of them through college.
But I mean, those are the benchmarks.
And none of them are as goofy as I am. So it's a great thing helping you not
win,
being
right?
Such an idiot. Yeah. When he said that, I thought about that the entire night. And I think I mentioned that to her the next day that, you know, do you think I won at life? And she goes, what? And now I definitely do. I feel like against all odds, because there's really nothing that makes me special about anything, that I have. Somehow I did. And I'm not sure if you said, how could you do that all over again? Not at my age. I could not do that all over again.
Terry Bores in studio. The book is The Score of a Lifetime, 25 years talking Chicago sports. And, you know, there's a lot I want to get to, and we'll probably run out of time. But I want to talk about when you knew, and maybe you never did, but when you knew that this format was taking off. If by 99, 7.5 years in, you're like, I don't know if this is working, and everyone's shuffling stuff around. When did you know? Also, what makes a great sports talk radio host? But the big thing I want to get to, I don't want to miss this, is just, you know, with your health and the fact that you were diagnosed kind of after the, you know, you had health issues, and out of those health issues, you were diagnosed with cancer, and out of that came chemotherapy and radiation. And in a way, came very close to robbing you of really what you wanted, which is to come back to the radio.
Mm-hmm. It did.
Take us to that spot. Take us to that moment of being a guy who knows all the sports cliches and knows everything about what sports means to us as people, and how you applied covering the sport and doing everything to having the fight of your lifetime.
The funny thing about the fight of your lifetime is that, you know, I spent a lifetime reading about guys who fought cancer, women who fought cancer, whatever. I mean, we're pretty aware of it. And I'm self-aware enough to know that, well, okay, I mean, that's my diagnosis. That wasn't what it was going in. That's what it turned out to be. And I was eager to get back to it. But I found that those days after the surgery, I had a June 16th of 2017, the first one. I had a second surgery on November 1st of 2016. Yeah. Sorry. You want to get back to what you do, because we're not physical guys. We're not out lifting concrete blocks. We're just talking. But I couldn't do that. I couldn't guarantee anybody that next day. I couldn't guarantee you 10 minutes down the road that I'd be well enough to do it. It was just so strange, the recovery. You know, I had a house full of nurses and people and feeding tubes and all the other stuff that I think once you – I had planned on retiring anyway, but I wanted to get back sooner because I knew the Cubs were going to be in the World Series. I knew it. I felt it the entire season. I knew it. So I checked the date of when the World Series started, which is October 24th, 2016. I said, okay, I'm going to be back by then. I did. I worked that week, and I literally collapsed by Friday. We had a remote downtown here, and I just was so far out of it. I mean, I was still in so much pain, and I walked back to the train, and I said, I can't, you know, I made it through the week, but my face was still swollen about two times normal size. I just had another surgery was coming. I went back to the hospital, forced my way in, and said, you got to do something about this. This isn't working because I'm out to here. So it was very difficult for the job we do to say, well, I can't do that. That sounds like you're being the biggest sissy in the world. I can't do that. And I couldn't. I couldn't possibly be reliable enough to say, well, no, don't worry about that. I'll be there in 2 weeks. I learned over a period of time there that I just couldn't say that anymore. I can't. It would be easier to just say, you know what, give me a month or give me 2 months or whatever. Because I, as much as my heart wanted to come back, right, and I really wanted to be back, I couldn't.
Did you have to come to terms with that? Did you have?
I did. It was very difficult because you find out when they take away what you do. And it was taken away. Clearly, for me to be in front of a microphone 5 hours a day just wasn't going to happen. It just was not going to happen. And I thought, well, okay, next week I'll feel better. Let's talk on Monday. We'll see how we're doing. No, it never, you know, so I started thinking more in terms of months or weeks. And then for a while I wasn't sure. And then when this thing was swollen up again and I knew I needed more surgery, at least I was going to go ask for it, because they wouldn't do anything about it right away. I just had a feeling that was it. There's no way, even now, if somebody said to me, I couldn't promise you that. I feel good most days now. I'm pretty good, much better. I think I'm over the chemo, and then the radiation takes an effect on you that really I think people don't quite understand how awful it is until you've had it done. And I had it in the face, so... it robs you of everything you've ever worked for, everything you've ever done. You don't even have the energy to sit down and write. If even I want to sit down and write, just say I just want to write a column or write something for the website, I couldn't do it.
Does this book that just came out in November, does it mean more to you with the feelings and emotions that you were just talking about, the idea that you're not sure you're going to be able to even write?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I when I came back last year, we for the first time, we left for the winter and came back in April. And I had made the promise to everybody, really, that I was writing this book. So I thought, well, if I sit down every day and write 2,000 words, reasonable, in 6 weeks, I got a lot of words. I got a lot of words to go. But you can't have that day where you say, I can't write anymore.
Yeah.
You can't let it get you, even though I was in pain and it was still bothering me. I still had attendants coming over. I still had people coming over. I still had physical therapy stuff I had to do and all the other things. I still found time to sit down and write those 2,000 words a day. Did they always make sense? Probably not. But that I could do. And it convinced me that, yeah, you can do this. You can do this. And the one thing you can't do is just, I don't feel like it today. You know, we don't have a job where you say, I don't feel like it today. I mean, you just, it's no. not that kind of job. We should be grateful and underneath pray and thankful for what we do for a living, because that's really what it is. It's a blessing. It's not a curse. It's not anything else. And I sort of look at it and say, well, writing was a great help for me. It helped me. It was a great thing to sit down and put all this crap together. And, it helped me a great deal mentally. Because it proved to me that I can still do something. If I can't ever talk again for a period of time, if I can't ever do whatever I want to for a period of time again. Because when you're going through this, you question it. You just wonder, am I ever going to be anything close to normal again? Am I ever going to be the guy I once was, or even... Because I lost 50 pounds. Mm-hmm. Went from 225 to 177. I mean, I was physically unable to do, you know, much of anything. And a feeding tube is not... You can't really pig out on a feeding tube. So I questioned everything. So writing was actually therapy. It was actually therapy for me. I also have made it my habit over the years to keep a promise. And if I promise somebody I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it.
To think that the score at 25 years, 2017, to think of a sports radio format in Chicago, do you look back on that? Do you look back on your career at the score and recognize the contributions and the legacy that you leave behind? Because there is no sports radio without Terry Bors. You have had your name, your voice, your imprint, everything on it, everything that Chicago's done for a quarter of a century.
See, I still struggle to cope with that, with praise. I think that, you know, sports radio will go on forever in this town, and there will always be sports talk radio in this town, and there will always be somebody to do it. And the score has done so much for me as well. I mean, they've helped me in all countless ways and always have, that I don't feel that way. See, one of the guys I love took my place. The guy that produced for us, I loved it. And I mean, when I left, I said, got to give this job to Jason. I mean, Jason deserves the job. And eventually he did get it. Wasn't my recommendation, I'm sure. And you make up your own mind. But no, I kind of look at it like a lot of old entertainers that, you know, there's always somebody come along that somebody's going to love more. That's okay. I mean, I've watched people for decades now, and I always say, meh. I'm on doing my bucket list now, the things I want to do for myself right. before I go. So I when I look at this, I say, over a period of time, they'll forget. Generations change, people change, and all of that changes. And maybe there'll always be a Terry Bors way at the station, that sort of thing. But no, I don't ever think that my imprint is such that it'll always be there. I look at guys who did a hell of a lot more than I did with their lives. And, you know, if you really make a lasting imprint, you're very lucky. And you're also way above my pay scale. So, I mean, I don't think that's true. But sports talk is not going away. And that makes me proud that at least that much of it, it's not going away.
It's awesome to hear your voice. It's awesome to meet you as a longtime listener to you for years. It's a pleasure to read the book, The Score of a Lifetime, 25 years talking Chicago sports. Terry Bors in studio. Terry, a pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.